The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and our guest this week is Wade Fow, examining your retirement income tool chest. It's like a chocolate factory. You select and pick based on what will really work for what you need to have done. You know, I'm one of my own biggest critics. Whenever I put something in place like a procedure or something that I think is good in my own life and my business life, my wife tells me I'm my own worst critic. I'm always criticizing what it is I'm doing, checking it and then rechecking it and rethinking it and making sure that it's really achieving the goals that we said we should achieve. Well, guess what? That's something you may want to do about retirement income, because for almost 60 years, there was pretty much accepted in the industry a three-legged stool of planning for retirement, and that involves Social Security, pensions, and savings. And you put all those three together and figured it out, and that's how you structured your package. However, the times, they are a-changing. And if things change, then your thinking has to change with it. So, whither go we, Jim?
The things that we're talking about, and this was anytime somebody thought about retirement. First, you always thought about a pension if you worked for a company or you worked for the government. Secondly, you always thought about Social Security. And then third, anything left over if you had savings. But John, everything that we know about that three-legged stool has changed since the 2008 financial crisis. Pensions have been changing, and that's been changing over, let's say, I would say probably the last three decades, that we went away from defined benefit pension plans. And we're going to be talking about on the program today, having and creating your own private pension plan. But pension plans have changed. No longer if you work for a company. Well, first of all, most people don't work for companies 30 years today. It's very rare that you find somebody that goes to work out of college, gets a job with the company, and retires with the Timex watch and a pension. That era no longer exists. And according to the Wall Street Journal, the average college student today getting out of school can expect to have 4 to 5 different jobs by the time they get to retirement. So if you think about 4 or 5 jobs, you know, the only thing that you have today is really most companies have gone to something called a defined contribution plan, which really shifted the risk over to you, the employee. I mean, you have a 401k program, you know, whatever you put in that program, whatever the employer puts in that program and whatever it grows to, that's it. And that's what you're going to have to retire. So pensions have changed, number one. Number two, the investment environment has changed. You know, we had a 2-decade period of time where stocks went up 15, 20% a year. And what happened is that people stopped saving in the 90s. I mean, you didn't need to because stocks were going up double digits a year. Well, we're not in that environment. In fact, in my interview coming up later on in the program, I'll be talking to Professor Fow how much this investment environment has changed. We're also dealing in an era of zero interest rates. In fact, if you look around the globe, almost 1/3 of all sovereign bonds are actually negative. Something we covered on the weekend program, they're actually paying, think about this, folks, talk about turning the world upside down. They are paying borrowers money to borrow, and they're penalizing savers. So this whole world is topsy-turvy right now, and has changed completely the whole paradigm that most people have thought about when it comes to retirement.
Well, there are still some defined benefit plans out there, but most of them tend to be in government. And if we turn the focus on government, you look at the number of municipalities, let's start at that level, whether county or cities, that are in financial trouble and may not be able to back up what they promised in pensions, not to mention some states. So, yeah, they exist, but the question will be, will you be able to collect them when you get to retirement? So that may be going the way of the dodo bird as well.
Yeah, and I suspect that's what you're going to see by the time you get into the next decade. I think you're going to see defined benefit pension plans faded out for government workers, and new government workers will have something like a 457 plan or the equivalent of a 401k plan. But the way a defined benefit plan works, because we're going to get into this, you can still have one if you have assets that you've saved up. But basically, when you used to work for, let's say, I don't know, you worked for General Electric, you worked for IBM, under a defined benefit, your employer was required to put so much money aside each year to fund your retirement. So depending on how many years of service you had with the company, whether it was 20 years, 30 years, you got X amount of your salary. It might have been 50%, 60%, all the way up to 70 and 80%. Same thing that governments are doing today. And then when you got to retirement, the company took aside the money that they were required to put aside for you. They went to insurance company and they said, you know, Bob is age 65, his wife is age 60. How much money will you give them for the rest of both of their lives? And you would get the options. That's basically the way a defined benefit plan worked. And it's still possible to do that today, but it's a private pension plan, which is what an immediate annuity is. And we'll get into that later on. But, you know, it's a different world today. And there are different options that you have, and you better consider all of them, because even in the financial planning area, a lot of the assumptions that are being used in financial plans today are faulty assumptions. They're based on historical returns. You know, it's great to assume that you're going to make 10% in the market, but realistically, folks, that's not going to be the case. And we'll show you here in a minute as we examine market returns why that doesn't work anymore. But it's a different world, and it's going to require different strategies to rethink of how you're going to get that retirement income.
I think the solution to this, Jim, is not to get older.
Die young?
Yeah, well, die young while you have the opportunity to do so, because if you look at this, look at the dilemma we're facing right now. Social Security has been altered. We've commented that on some of the shows that we've done. And frankly, it's just going to get worse and worse as the U.S. debt rises and financial crises arise. The number two, defined benefit plans, pensions, pretty well gone. Defined contributions now seem to be, what, the end thing type of thing. If we look at financial repression and 0% interest rates, even if we did up at just a quarter of a point recently, that's creating an atmosphere where you, or not situation actually better than an atmosphere, where you can't get much on things like savings and other investments that are tied to that interest rate. And then people are just living longer. Okay. And that's a good thing, but you have to plan for a longer period of time if you don't intend to work during your retirement.
Well, it's a different world. And it's not just that one thing has changed. Every leg of that three-legged stool is changing. And if you could sum it all up, the gist of all of it is the burden for your retirement, the burden and the risk is all being transferred to you, the individual. When companies switched over from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans like 401k, you took on the risk of securing your income when you retire. When it was a defined benefit plan, the risk was all on the company because they were required to meet an obligation that they would give to you when you retired. When they got rid of that obligation and went to a defined contribution plan like the popular 401ks, the risk is all on your shoulders because the company's not going to guarantee you anything. They might contribute to your plan with matching contributions, but basically, folks, it's your responsibility. Whatever you put aside, whatever you earn, how you manage that money, all that risk is on you. And when it comes to Social Security, they just altered it. They took away favorable benefits that would have helped women out because they're the main survivor. 85% of all beneficiaries, surviving beneficiaries of Social Security are women. Let's face it, if you're a woman listening to this program, you have a longer lifespan than the average male. So the greater risk in terms of poverty or running out of money is going to lie primarily with you. So Social Security is being altered, and then we talked about, and we're going to get into here, an example of what happened to the investment markets. But the other thing, John, too, is, you know, it's great that we've made all these advances in medicine, and we can say, look what we're doing. People are living longer. When they put Social Security in effect, the average lifespan for a male was 65 compared to today, 85. And I'm going to give an example here. If you are male, age 65, you have a 10% chance of living to age 96. Now, let's assume for illustration purposes, and this will make more and more sense as we get into some of the solutions we're going to talk about. Let's say that you live on $100,000 a year. You're 65 now. At age 96, you're going to need $100,000 to live the final year of your life. Given where the world is today, given where bond rates are, let's say you went into a 30-year bond, corporate bond, you could find 3%. You would need to set aside $41,200 today at age 65 to have $100,000 at age 96. Now, what happens today and what companies do, insurance companies, and we're going to get into annuities later on with Professor as well as this segment of the program. What insurance companies do is they take a look at people age 65. Now, let's just take 10 people. They know that statistically out of 10 people, there's only one of you that is going to end up living to age 96. So what an insurance company does is they count on others not living as long to subsidize those that are going to live longer. It's no different than what an automobile company does when they insure you on your car. They might quote you a rate and they're going to assume that you're a good driver, and a lot of good drivers will make up for that bad driver or that unexpected event that nobody counted on. So in this case, the $41,200, what an insurance company would do is they would pull money or premiums from individuals versus $41,200, they would get 10 individuals and it would only be $4,120 because the insurance company knows that only one of you are going to live to that long. And that's one of the advantages. It's called pooled risk that insurance companies have. And they're talking about the investment industry heading in the same direction because annuities are coming back, folks. And they're coming back because of the unpredictability of the market. Secondly, people don't have as much money as they thought they were going to have when they get to retirement. And the third factor is that people are living longer. That is what insurance companies do. Actually, you know, when you boil it all down, short lives subsidize long lives. And one of the greatest risks that you're going to face in your retirement years is it's great that you're going to be healthier. You'll live a healthier retirement, but outliving your money and dying broke because of longevity.
Let's look at Social Security. You know, this is becoming a moving target. At one point, it was fairly stable. But, you know, we understand that our government is operating in an unsustainable way that sooner or later comes home. Congress critters there know that Social Security has a problem because the disability fund was in trouble this last year and they fixed it. But it's a one-year fix. And so what we're seeing now is a bunch of fixes. And usually it's robbing from something else to pay something else at this stage, but that can't go on forever either.
That's precisely what they did, too. They robbed from Social Security, reduced the benefits to pay for a one-year disability fix.
Okay, so where is that going to head, though, in the future with Social Security?
I think what you're going to do is, you know, going back to 1984, where they increased Social Security taxes, then in the 90s, what they did is they began taxing Social Security. Well, they began taxing Social Security in the 80s as well. 50% of your income became subject to taxation depending on how much income you made. Then in the 90s, they began taxing 85% of your Social Security. So, you know, eventually, John, they'll probably go to 100%. I think they're going to have to extend, and this goes along with longevity. They are going to extend when you get your Social Security. They've already done it for 2 years. If you're a millennial, right now it's age 67, not age 65. For us boomers, it's age 66. So they are extended 1 year for us boomers. John, the actuarial figures I'm looking at, because they're looking at this right now, folks. Forget everything that you hear politicians saying on TV or giving a speech. I mean, these critters know better. An election year, remember, you promise all kinds of goodies, candy and lollipops to the voters. But the figures that I'm looking at, they're talking about beginning benefits maybe at age 65 and full benefits at age 69. Right now, it's partial benefits at age 62, full benefits at age 66 if you're a boomer. So they're going to move those years up, and that will take some of the pressure off. And so Social Security is going to be moved down the road. So if you're Gen Xer, you're millennial, don't think age 67. Start thinking age 69 and age 65 is going to be more realistic. They're going to have to do it, John, because there simply isn't the money. So we know changes are coming to Social Security. There's just not enough workers out there, and that trust fund does not exist. The government spent the money. And I was surprised to see that actually brought up in some of the Republican debates of politicians finally admitting to brokers there is no trust fund. It's empty. They spent the money.
Yeah, that was Governor Mike Huckabee, as I recall. He said it several times now. It's empty. It's nothing but IOUs.
Yeah. Had they put that excess money and invested it, we wouldn't be in the fix today. But, you know, they basically, you know, I hate to say it, there's no other word. They stole it. Simply, they stole it and spent it. And, you know, John, if you and I did that, let's say you're running a company and you had a pension plan and you did that, where employees put money in a 401k plan. Let's say each month they put money in a pension plan. And then you, the employer, took that money out and spent it on, you know, lifestyle and living. And you bought yourself a boat, a yacht, a plane, or whatever it is. And you put an IOU in there. You know what would happen? You'd be in prison right now. But, you know, when you're a politician, you're exempt. But basically, they stole it. And that's one of the main reasons that we're in trouble with Social Security today.
All right, let's roll to the issue of pensions. Pensions used to be the big thing in companies where, you know, you work for a company for 40 years. And like I said one time before, they give you a crummy watch and give you a pension. That's changing, though.
And it really did, because in order to keep a defined benefit pension plan in place, it required larger and larger contributions. And companies just basically were looking at it and say, hey, you know, we can't afford to make these contributions. And so what they did is they turned to defined contribution plans, your popular 401k. And I hate to tell you, if you're working for government or thinking of working for government down the road, that is coming to government. My prediction, you will see that become widespread as more and more cities and states get themselves in financial trouble. I can't tell you how many states, very few states, have funded pension plans today. They're all running major deficits. We had a speech last year by the head of CalPERS, and he's basically saying, we can't make it. We're going to have to raise taxes because we're not going to be able to fund these pension benefits. And there's going to be a revolt by the private sector basically trying to fund lavish pensions for the public sector. So that's going to change. So it is going to be a different environment. And that responsibility, I mean, the gist of this program today is rethinking your retirement income, because the responsibility and risk of your retirement is going to be pushed back to you, the individual.
Now, here comes the dismal one, too. The financial returns on savings or other such dollar-denominated instruments isn't just the bonanza that it used to be. Remember 30, 40 years ago, not only could you get, like, on treasury bills, you could get a decent return, and it was guaranteed, you know, guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. Yeah, I'm sorry, I won't comment on that at this stage of the game. But anyway, that's just not there anymore. And for the near foreseeable future, will not be.
No, it isn't. And, you know, the financial returns on savings today, we're operating in a much, much different environment today. People had a hard time adjusting to negative interest rates. And folks, you know, my good friend Gary Schilling, who wrote about this in his book in 2010, his recent newsletter said he's upped his projections. He says, we're in this environment for another 7-8 years. So we may be 2 decades, just like Japan. You don't think it can happen here? It's been in Japan for over 2 decades. So, John, this isn't going away. And listen to last weekend's show, because we covered this on the debt supercycle and negative interest rates. It's something that you are going to have, because the next time we get in a downturn, I think we may end up with negative interest rates. I mean, they're trying it, and there's a number of reasons. We talked about why central bankers like it and governments like it. I mean, think about it. If you're a government, how would you like to issue debt where the people that loan you money, actually, you charge them? You don't have to pay them interest. They pay you interest.
Where do I sign up?
I imagine. But that's the world we live in today. Borrowers are actually being paid interest with negative interest rates, and savers are being penalized. That's the world and reality that we live in and we're going to be in for such a long time.
Let's talk about the sequence of returns and in planning some of the cash flow in your retirement. I know you and Wade Fowler are going to discuss this later on in the program, but why is this important? Because we've seen a couple of market downturns over the last few years. How does this affect that?
Well, I mean, let's make this real easy. Let's just assume, and we'll make this for illustration purposes, that you needed $40,000 of income from your portfolio to supplement your living. And let's say you had $1 million, and so you need $40,000. What you would do, theoretically, you would draw down from your portfolio $40,000 a year. Now, let's assume that half of your portfolio is invested in bond mutual funds or ETFs. The other half is invested in stock mutual funds. So each month, you're selling off shares to live on. Well, imagine what happens when you're selling off shares when the market is falling. There's a double whammy effect. I mean, between 2007 and 2009, the market was down 45%. So you're selling off shares in a down market, meaning you're getting less money for every share that you sell. And you experience something like that early on in your retirement, you may not recover. So you really have to be very careful when you first retire that you do not have this happen to you, because you'll never recover.
We need to deal with another contrast too here. A lot of the retirement industry has always said invest for the long run, but other groups such as insurance company, which sell various types of securities or things related to this, are saying, no, you have to invest on a basis of probability. And remember, when you used to retire, security in the long run was what you cared about. So what is with this contrast now?
Well, I mean, the investment industry, going on historical returns, I mean, the stock market has been one of the best places to be. But we're going to show you here in a moment why that's not necessarily true anymore. And so the investment industry is more oriented, because that's what the investment industry does, is sell investment products or investment management. The insurance company, on the other hand, says, look, let us assume the risk, because there's going to be less risk to you, because we're going to pull risk together. Like the example I gave of 10 individuals living to 90, only one's going to live to age 96. So the insurance company collects premiums from 10 individuals, knowing that only one person out of the 10 will make it to age 96. So that's why, that's what the insurance company sells. And we live in an era where it's less predictable. The market returns. There was a study that was just released this week by McKinsey and Company. They're saying over the next decade, you know, stock market returns are estimated to be 4%. Now, that's better than zero. But folks, the days of 10% returns are unrealistic. They just don't exist anymore. I mean, you may get a brief spurt like we did coming out of the downturn in 2009, when the Fed and the government were injecting trillions of dollars. But remember, the market was down 45%, and trillions of dollars were injected into the economy. So it did well. But, you know, you can't expect, and you got to take those returns when they come. But a lot of people, John, didn't. And that's why they're in trouble today.
Well, what did happen to the 10% returns? I mean, why aren't they working anymore?
We basically went through a stock market bubble. And it's interesting because, and let me just give you an example. We did a Bloomberg study. We took the S&P 500 from January 1st, 2000 to April of 2013, April 1st. Now, the reason we did that is it was the month of April 2013 that the stock market, reflected by the S&P, finally exceeded the record set in March of the year 2000. So if you were spending the income, you weren't reinvesting the dividend, in that 13-year period, the stock market was up 8.73%. So you would have got less than 0.75% a year in return on the market. Now, if you reinvested your dividends, the total return on the S&P was roughly 40%, an average of 2.5%. So, you know, forget the 10% returns. That's not the world that we live in. So for almost a 13, 14-year period, John, the return with reinvested dividends was only 2.5%, not the 10% that is used in most financial planning software.
Yeah, but Jim, bonds were doing pretty well during that period of time. I mean, if we're following your logic here, what happened to them?
Let's just take the last 10 years. In 2006, you could have got 5.25% on a 10-year treasury note. And usually when you got into financial crisis, it was the Fed raising interest rates. And that's what happened. They raised the Fed funds rate to over 5%. 10-year treasury notes were 5.25%. Fast forward to the year 2016, 10 years later, John, the 10-year treasury note was 1.75%, or even worse. Think of somebody that retired in the year 2000, went into a bond fund, and was getting income off the bond fund or the stock fund. Well, the stock market returned less than 0.75% if you were living off dividends. And during that same period of time, the annual income from your bond fund went down. Greenspan brought interest rates down beginning in the year 2000, all and kept them there to 2004, began to raise them to 2006 when they got up to 5.25%. But then right after the financial crisis hit, we brought them down to zero. I'll give you an example. Let's take two popular ETFs, LQD, which is the corporate bond fund, and TLT. And if you look at the rate of returns, the annual dividend growth rate was a negative 5.2% for both funds, meaning that if you were in LQD, your income fell by over 5% a year. Over the last 3 years, it's been 4%. If you were in TLT, in the last year, your income dropped in dividends by almost 7%. So you can see there, John, the predictability of these kind of returns, they're just not realistic. I mean, who would have known in the year 2000 that we'd be looking at 1/3 of the sovereign bonds in the world would actually charge you, the owner of a bond, interest? In other words, you would pay the government money to loan them money. But that is nonetheless the world that we live in today.
Okay. Well, obviously, we wouldn't be talking about this if we didn't think there were some ways around this. It's simply understanding what the new situation is and then what you can do to not avoid the problems, but to fix the problem, shall we say.
Right now, there are a number of options. You can delay retirement. So instead of retiring at age 62 or age 65, you basically delay your retirement, which means you're not drawing on your funds and you have fewer years to draw on them. A second option, which is a lot of people are using today, is you work part-time. You don't fully retire, or maybe you retire from your regular job, but you do something different in retirement. Third option is basically create a private pension plan through your own private annuity. So, you know, there are a number of things that you can do. And what I want to do now is I want to cover annuities versus investment in terms of how they impact four different areas: lifestyle, longevity, liquidity, and legacy. Now, from an investment point of view, lifestyle should improve on the investment side because investments grow. The negative to that is the sequence of risk that we talk about. What if you retired, let's say, in 2007, you go through a bear market? Longevity. You know, figure you're going to spend 25 years in retirement, or the average couple between the two of you. With sufficient time, the market's probably going to give you more upside, which will help improve your lifestyle. However, a lot of that depends on the investment environment. As I just mentioned, we went through 13 years where the investment environment was low. Liquidity. That's a great aspect of investments. Your assets are liquid. And on legacy, whatever you have in your portfolio, you leave to your heirs. From the insurance perspective, lifestyle, you don't have the risk of longevity or sequence risk because the insurance company guarantees that income for as long as you live. However, you're going to give up some upside because they're going to give you a rate. And that rate or whatever the income they're going to give you, you're going to get that today and you're going to give it as long as you live. So the pros are you don't have to worry about longevity risk. The problems, like anything else, you better pick a good insurance company because you want to go with the top quality company, just like you'd want to go with the top blue chip company. Liquidity, depending on what kind of contract you have, there are options for liquidity. But generally, once you sign up on an immediate annuity, that's basically it. In terms of legacy, well, there is no legacy unless you pick various options for a guaranteed period that's going to pay out. But that's, you know, when you had a defined benefit pension plan from a company, when both spouses died, there wasn't anything that was given to your kids. So it's the same thing. So there's pros and cons, John, of both sides of that story.
It seems that annuities either get a bum rap or get a praise deal, because some people, if you watch the talkie channels, will say they're great. Others will say they aren't. Why this disparity between the two?
You know, I think it has to do with, it's like any industry, folks, whether it's law, accounting, investments, or any kind of field, you have some bad apples that kind of spoil it. And there are some unscrupulous people in the industry that sell a product or a high commission product or sell something when it's not really needed. So, you know, there's a number of things wrong, but I think there are very useful investment tool for retirement today in today's low interest rate environment. I mean, we haven't used annuities until financial repression came. I mean, we just didn't use immediate annuities until the last 3 or 4 years, John, because, you know, up until then, I could get 5 or 6% in a bond, you know, and the stock market was going up. And if you take a look at the 80s and 90s, my goodness, you know, in the 80s, you got double digit yields on bonds, high single digits in the 90s, and then, of course, mid single digits in the last decade. So, you know, they're more appropriate today. But like anything else, you need to do your research. You want to make sure that you're buying a high quality company, A+ rated by AM Best or Wise. And the problem is, there's so many products out there today. I mean, just take a look at the plethora of ETFs. You can get ETFs on almost every investment class. And it's the same thing with annuity features. The insurance companies keep adding options because people ask for them. Hey, I want a death option, or one, I want a long-term care option, or one, I want a liquidity option, or one, I want a guaranteed step up in the basis of my annuity, no matter what the stock market does. So it's more complex. And I think that's one reason. And a lot of times people don't do a good job, or the salespeople or the advisor doesn't do a good job explaining the benefit. But they are one tool that you need to look at if you don't have enough income or you're concerned about safety. I mean, there's been over 2,000 papers written by annuities by professors at college, and 99% of professors at colleges, from Robert Merton, Nobel laureate at Harvard, to today, my guest, Wayne Fowle, are in favor of annuities in many cases where they really fit a retirement portfolio.
All right, well, where are they appropriate?
I think they're appropriate for individuals that have been scarred by two bear markets, that are really more concerned about safety of principal, don't want to run the risk of a portfolio dropping in a bear market. I think they're also appropriate for people that simply do not have enough funds accumulated in their pension or their personal savings, and their Social Security isn't that much, where they just don't have enough to live on. And then also for those individuals, John, that have longevity, that run in the family. You know, I just recently lost a client, but her husband lived to 97 years old and she lived to 94 years old. And so we're seeing it more and more. And the retirement home that she was living in, they have people in their hundreds. So longevity is an issue. But I would say if you're concerned about safety, you don't have enough assets, or you're one of the fortunate that has good genes, you get taken care of yourself and your body, and longevity is part of your family.
Having prepped you with all of this, time to go to our real-life case study. As with all of our case studies here on Lifetime Income, these are based on real-life experiences, but the names have been changed to protect the privacy of the people involved. So what do we have this week? Bill and Jan Smith.
Yeah, this case study that we actually talked about on the show last year, but I want to run it again because it's a good example that covers many of the issues that we've covered today. Bill, age 66, was retired, and he retired at age 60. Unfortunately, the year he retired was the year we went into a recession and bear market. Jan, his wife, age 58, she was going to retire in 2 years. She was a school teacher. Her salary was $80,000 a year. Bill's Social Security was $1,450 a month, roughly about $17,400. Jan, when she retires, she will get from the school system, her pension will cover 66% of her years of work. So 66% of her $80,000 salary would be $54,120. So a combination of Jan's pension and Bill's Social Security would be $71,520. Unfortunately, their budget was $105,000. So without investments, they were short roughly $34,000 a year. Now, their budget, and I mean, a lot of you living in the Midwest or in Florida, this may sound high. Essential budget here in California, $90,000 a year. Quality of life, golf, and some travel, $10,000. And what I call want-to-haves, $5,000 a year, they would put money in a 457 plan for their grandkids. So total budget, $105,000, shortfall roughly a little over $33,000 a year.
And what about assets?
Well, they had a home. It was $450,000, but there was a mortgage on it. Bill's IRA was $650,000. It was mainly in cash. By the way, that used to be an $800,000 IRA. When he retired, he lost $150,000 in the downturn. Jan's 403B savings plan with the school system was worth roughly about $300,000, and their personal savings at the bank was $40,000. So total assets just slightly under $1 million, roughly $990,000. So total assets of $1,440,000, including the home, liabilities, mortgage on the home, $300,000. Their net worth was about $1.1 million. The problems that we were dealing with is that Bill's health, Bill had cardiovascular disease. He had a heart attack, and he's taken medication to keep his cholesterol down, blood thinners. Secondly, is Bill was 8 years older than Jan, and Jan had longevity on her side. One parent living to almost the age 90, but both parents living to late 80s. So the real issue was outliving assets, especially for Jan, because she's more likely, given Bill's health, given the fact she's 8 years younger, that she was going to outlive her husband. The other issue that we were dealing was Bill's market fears. I mean, you know, when you lose $150,000 of your savings, you know, right off the bat when you start your retirement, you can imagine a lot of people out there are just, you know, they don't want to be in the stock market. They don't like it. They don't trust the market. It's unpredictable. So basically, that was the issue, John. We had some assets, but the assets had to be redeployed differently.
Okay, so putting all this together, the solution was?
One of the things that we had is there's no way you're going to take somebody that is afraid of the stock market and basically put them back on the market. But I was able to convince Bill. I said, Bill, there are certain things that you're going to have to do. Your wife is 8 years younger than you. She's got longevity in the family. We have to have something in growth here, and you got to increase your savings. But what we did is we put $500,000 into bonds at 4%. That produced $20,000 of income. And then we took $150,000 and put it in dividend-paying stocks at 3%. That was $4,500 a year. Now, Jan, we did something different. Jan had $300,000 in her annuity at work. And what we did is we took $230,000 of that annuity and annuitized it based on Jan's life only, and that would produce $24,000 a year annual income, $2,000 a month for the rest of Jan's life. And then the remaining balance we put in dividend paying ETFs at roughly almost 3%, and that was $2,100. So total investment income was $50,600. Total income now was $122,000 against a budget of $105,000. They now had a surplus of $17,000 a year.
Just out of curiosity, why did you put the annuity just on Jan's life and not on Bill's?
Well, first of all, there was an 8-year age difference. Second, Bill's health issues. And we did something called a 10-year certain on it, meaning that if Jan suddenly got a rare disease and she passed away before Bill, there would be 10 years worth of payments that would continue. So we locked in 10-year certain, meaning that if Jan died prematurely, she got in a car wreck or something like that, then those payments we made to Bill. But if we would have put Bill on it, the payments would have been substantially lower. And the greatest risk in longevity here, quite honestly, because of age difference, genetics, and everything else, and health issues, was Jan. So that's the reason we did that. First of all, in terms of Bill's health, we did not need to worry about long-term care. Fortunately, that was something that they took out in their 50s, which was a smart move on their part, especially since they were thinking about longevity issues. That was before Bill knew he had heart disease. Inflation and health care we handled with dividend growth. And something that we did, because Jan basically said, they had a townhome, and they said, you know, I want to live here. We're on a golf course. We play golf here. This is where our friends are. You know, I don't want a mortgage payment. So we refinanced the house, on a 15-year mortgage, meaning that in 15 years, so when Jan is basically age 73, that house will be free and clear. We got rid of the market fears with laddered bonds, and then we made up the loss of Jan's income from retiring from her $80,000 salary. We made up that loss of income with the monthly annuity.
Well, there were some interesting things that happened here because, first of all, they took out a long-term care policy, and they did that in the 50s before they knew that Bill had cardiovascular disease. You handled the idea of both inflation and health care with dividend growth. Now, they did have a house on a golf course, but they didn't want to have mortgage payment on it, so you refinanced it on a 15-year mortgage, and that means that when Jan would get to about age 73, the house would be then free and clear, and laddered bonds pretty much got rid of the market fear. You know, so that's how it went.
Yeah, I wish, quite honestly, I wanted to put more in dividend paying stocks, but there's just no way. You know, when somebody gets traumatized, I mean, you can imagine, John, and it's understandable. You retire, and the year you retire happens to be the year the recession starts in a bear market that would take stocks down 45%. I mean, if you lose 150 grand right off the bat from your retirement, a little more. I mean, he made up some of the difference with interest. I think he told me at one time he was down like $180,000. So, I mean, you can imagine your reluctance. So, I mean, if it was my way, I would have put, you know, at least $250,000 in stocks instead of $150,000. But it was a miracle that we got him to put $150,000. But, you know, that's worked out real well because we saw a lot of upturn. The dividends, the thing that he likes is those dividend payments increase each year, which he's seen the benefit of that. And of course, now the whole plan itself was generating surplus income. So their bank account is built up as well.
So there it is, another successful story. And coming up next, Dr. Wade Fow will be Jim's guest. Your retirement income tool chest as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, it's no secret today that it's getting harder for many retirees to maintain a standard of living. Things have changed in the last decade. Stock market returns aren't where they used to be. Interest rates are much lower, and even part of Social Security benefits have been reduced. So what do retirees do? Do they stay in the market and take the risk, or are there alternatives? Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Fow from American College. And Professor, let's talk about the retirement tools that people have today, because traditionally, when you take a look at retirement, there's almost two schools of thought in the financial industry. There's one that stresses probability-based, or let's say market-type returns as the best solution for retirement. The other side of the industry comes from safety first, and that's the insurance industry that's saying, no, you're in retirement, you can't afford to take the risk, you're better off securing your income than you are making bets in the market. Let's talk about those two philosophies and how maybe sometimes the better approach is a combination of them.
Right. So the two philosophies, really, from the investment side, there's more of this focus on the idea that stocks outperform bonds over the long term. And that long term is short enough that individuals can really take advantage of that. So they're really focused on the upside growth potential of an aggressive investment portfolio. And on the insurance side, the focus is more on the idea of pooling the risk, and rather than having to bear all the risk. There's so many retirement risks that change once you enter retirement compared to pre-retirement. The longevity, not knowing how long to plan for, the market volatility that gets amplified when you're taking distributions from your investments. And rather than trying to manage all that risk on your own, which really requires being overly conservative with your spending, instead you should pool that risk and rely on some of the subsidization of essentially those who don't live as long, subsidize those who live longer, and that can allow everyone to really enjoy more spending over their lifetime. And so it's that belief that the stock market's going to outperform versus a belief that you can't really rely on stock market outperformance, that risk really gets amplified more in retirement and you should pull some of that risk.
You know, one of the common tools that we've used in the industry is withdrawal rates. And you and I have talked about this, what really works today, 3% or the 4% rule. And there's a problem with that because typically what happens, let's say you have a pool of assets. Let's just make this easy and say you have $1 million and that's invested half in stocks and half in bonds or some combination. And so you need $40,000 a year to supplement your income. So you're taking out $40,000 a year out of your investments. Now, a lot of people will be selling off shares of mutual funds. Let's talk about the sequence risk of what happens. For example, let's say you decided to retire January 1, 2008, and now you're drawing down 4% of your assets in probably one of the worst bear markets that we had since the beginning of the decade.
Right. And so it's not just if you consider, say, for example, someone will be planning for a 30-year retirement. They can't rely on what's the average market return going to be over the next 30 years. That kind of approach really only works if you're investing a fixed amount and leaving it alone in the market for 30 years. If you're adding new savings over time, there's a sequence of returns risk. The returns later on at the end of your career will matter more. But if you're taking distributions, there's sequence risk that gets even more amplified. And it's the returns early on that matter the most. And it's just simply this idea that if the market declines, you have to sell more shares to meet your spending goal. And then even if the market subsequently recovers, your portfolio is not going to get to enjoy that full recovery because there's less left to recover and you really can be left in a worse position. And that's that sequence risk that amplifies investment volatility, really front loads the risk to the beginning of retirement. And even though you may have a 30-year retirement, if you don't get decent market returns in the first 5 or 10 years, it doesn't matter how good things get later on. You're really not going to be able to sustain a high spending level over that retirement period.
Now, you've done a number of research when it comes to retirement portfolios. In contrary to what most people would think, in other words, just as we were talking there about sequence risk, when you first retire, you cannot afford to have a huge drawdown as a result of a bear market. The last one, the average stock in the S&P was down 45%. So you want to be as safe as possible. So you're going to probably have more safer investments up front. But given the end of your retirement, let's say an average retirement span of 25 years, you should have more in equities. That's almost the opposite of what most people would think.
Yeah, I think it's important to take less risk when you're the most vulnerable to the impacts of risk. And that can really be when you have the most wealth, where a given drop in the market can have the biggest impact on your total wealth holdings. So I do think having less risk around the retirement date is important. And if you are following some safety first type strategies where you build in a more secure floor to cover your basics or your lifestyle, that if you're not in a worst case scenario market environment, so that if markets do end up doing fine for you, just a natural outcome will be that your stock allocation as a portion of your total assets would tend to gravitate upwards throughout your retirement. That's just going to be a natural implication. But then that can also reduce some of the downside risk, taking away some of the risk right around the retirement date when you're most vulnerable to losing wealth.
Professor, why do you think that annuities have gotten such a bad rap? Because, you know, most people, let's say our parents that worked for companies, let's say they spent 25, 30 years, they worked at GM or some large American corporation, they got a pension when they retired. Most people don't realize what they got was really an annuity. The company, it could have been IBM or GM, put aside money for that person's retirement. When they got to retirement age, they went to an insurance company and they said, all right, the employee is age 65, his wife is age X. What can you give them for the rest of their life based on this pot of money? And then, of course, companies did away with those defined benefit pension plans, but aren't annuities the same kind of thing? Why do you think annuities have gotten such a bad rap?
Well, I think it's partly the insurance industry's fault that the very basic idea of an annuity, an income annuity, where you exchange a lump sum amount for an income for life, you're exactly right. That's what a defined benefit pension is. That's what Social Security is. But no one really has any incentive to sell those. the traditional investment managers don't want to lose assets to those. And also, like, commission-based insurance agents don't generally focus on income annuities because they are very low-commission products. And the insurance industry has developed a lot more complex types of annuities that represent most of the annuity sales and have higher commissions, so they're more attractive for salespeople to sell. But yeah, it's only the academics out there that really love income annuities and say over and over how these can really contribute to helping with longevity risk. And that I've even doing simulations, it's hard for upside growth potential from an investment portfolio to really outperform the mortality credit, the subsidy you get from having an income annuity when you live beyond your life expectancy. You're getting this unique source of returns. You're getting a payment based on living to your life expectancy, and then when you live beyond that, you're getting returns from those who didn't live as long. And it's hard for an investment portfolio to overcome that. So it really is a very attractive, even from an investment perspective, a really attractive option for retirement income. It can allow for ultimately a larger legacy, but people just have this bad idea about annuities. They're not willing to consider it. I think they partly don't look at liquidity in the right way. They say, with an investment portfolio, I have all this liquidity. I lose that liquidity with an annuity. But they're not really reflecting on the fact that they have to cover their spending goal for life. And that means most of their investment assets may not really be liquid in the sense that if they did spend them for something else, then they're gone. They're not there to cover that future spending goal. And I think if you look at what's true liquidity, what do you have left after you've covered all your spending goals? A lot of times an income annuity can meet the spending goals more cheaply, leaving more truly discretionary liquid assets available to be invested for more enjoyment or for legacy or whatever that case may be.
You know, it's really amazing too, because we've done studies. We ran a Bloomberg study on the S&P, and from January 1st, 2000 till April 1st, 2013, the stock market was up 8.9%, or an annual return with dividends reinvested of only 2.5%. Now, given in the year 2000 that we had just come off a multi-decade bull market, where, in fact, the last 5 years of that bull market, stocks were going up double digits every year, who would have thought, looking out 13 years, that the returns would be this low? That would be number one. Or number two, let's say, Professor, that you put half your portfolio in, let's say, a bond fund. In the year 2000, if you were in a bond fund, you were getting 8%. I mean, you're lucky if you get 3% today. So, you know, the average bond fund over the last 5 years has cut their dividends at an annual rate of over 5%.
Right. We are in this very low interest rate world, and Robert Shiller's talked a lot about the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, a way to try to smooth out some of the earnings volatility from market valuations. And that reached an all-time high in 2000. So that certainly suggested we would have lower returns subsequently, although people who just focused on the last few years would not have seen that coming, because, as you mentioned, the late 1990s was an amazing period for stock market performance. But we're still in an overvalued market environment based on Robert Shiller's cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio. And so we have low interest rates, we have overvalued stock markets. It really means that looking forward from today, retirees need to be at least planning on the possibility that returns will be lower than they've been historically over the long historical period in the U.S.
You know, McKinsey and Company just came out with a study this week, and they're estimating returns of about 4% for the stock market for exactly the thing you just mentioned, overvaluations. Periods of high valuations are always accompanied and followed by periods of low valuations, which means lower returns. So it's not just lower returns in the stock market, Professor. Unfortunately, in the past, if the stock market was getting pricey, if things were getting risky, and usually towards the end of a bear market, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates. Well, you know, the Fed has had a difficult time just raising interest rates a quarter of a point. But the point I'm making here is, in the past, you could always go to the bond market. You could say, okay, stocks are getting risky. They're getting overvalued. I'll go over to the bond market and I'll get a higher return. I mean, you could have got 5 or 6% back in 2007. There's no way you could get that today. In fact, you have almost just the reverse. Almost a third of the sovereign bonds around the globe are negative.
You're absolutely right that after periods where stock markets have done very well, we would expect interest rates to be higher, which then if there's a market decline, that would be offset partly by falling interest rates and starting from higher interest rates to begin with, bigger returns on bond portfolios. But that's not really all that feasible in today's environment where we have a 10-year treasury in the neighborhood of 1.8%. There's not really all that much further it can fall. And with that low starting point, it's not going to be able to offer the kinds of returns really that are needed to even meet something like the traditional 4% spending rule for retirement. It requires spending above what the bond yield curve can support to even spend at a 4% distribution rate. And then you're relying more and more in doing that on getting outsized stock market returns, which could happen. It could still work, but it's nowhere near as safe as I think a lot of people have gotten the idea that if they retire and use a 4% spending rate, they'll have a 95 or 100% chance for retirement success. And that's just not true. It can't be mathematically true in this kind of low interest rate world where it requires a spending down principal just to be able to meet that spending goal.
Yeah, you know, one of the problems, though, is a lot of industry software today uses these kind of assumptions when you're forecasting or doing a retirement plan. You're looking at an extended period of time of a drawdown, and there's a sort of implicit assumptions that are being made about these returns, in many cases explicit assumptions about these returns that are used in these plans that are based on historical figures, which, as we know, we're dealing in a different market environment today.
Right. That's one of my biggest pet peeves, that if you do plug in historical averages, which means something like an intermediate term government bond historically was getting 5.5% type returns, that's really just not mathematically possible today. But that's what gets plugged into a lot of the financial planning software. And with those historical averages, it does give you like a 95% chance for success for the 4% rule. But it's not mathematically feasible to get those kinds of returns. And the argument in favor of doing that is, well, just trying to say, who can predict what's going to happen in the future? The best we can do is plug in the historical averages. Well, for bonds, you can predict bond returns. If you hold a bond to maturity, its return is going to be its yield. And then if you sell it before maturity, you could have a capital gain or capital loss, but it's going to be centered around today's yield. And it's just not realistic to get historically higher bond returns when you start from such a low level. And so that's one of my biggest pet peeves about a lot of the existing financial planning software out there. It really puts advisors in a tough situation as well, because if a individual is looking at two different advisory firms and one firm tells them, oh, your plan will have a 99% chance for success, the other firm tells them, you know, you only have an 80% chance for success, that individual is naturally going to think that it's just the 99% chance for success, that's a more competent advisor that knows what they're doing, that has got things figured out, when the reality is that's the incompetent advisor who's using unrealistic assumptions and probably doesn't even realize it, and that plan's really not going to work the way that those two parties believe it will.
Yeah, that's one of the problems sometimes, and very competitive in the industry. You go to one person, as you mentioned, and their plan says you only have maybe a 60, 70, 80% chance of success. And you go to somebody else and they say, well, my plan will give you a 90, 95%. And you don't realize it's the assumptions that are being used in the plan that may be totally faulty and could lead to distortions and problems down the road.
Yeah, it's not that advisor with the higher chance for success is a better advisor. It's just that they're using unrealistic assumptions that they probably don't even understand.
So given this nature, let's talk about bonds, because some people say, well, you know, it's cheaper. Why not put a bond portfolio together? Let's say you put a laddered bond portfolio together where you have maturities from a couple of years all the way out to 5, 10, or 15 years. The problem I have with that, Professor, is once again, going back to the year 2000, if you would have known in the year 2000 that interest rates would get down to zero or negative, you would have gone with 20 and 30 year bonds and locked that in. But nobody knew that. So if you had a laddered bond portfolio as they were coming due, some of those bonds were reinvested at a lower interest rate.
Right. Well, for retirement, I usually think of bond ladders more from the perspective of when the bond matures, you're not going to reinvest it. That's actually the spending you want for that year. Yeah, if you are simply just building a bond ladder that you're going to roll over and keep reinvesting, then it is a different type of environment. When somebody's retired, that may be a less common type of situation to see them rolling over bond ladders. But I would agree with your point that that is one of the big risks of rolling over a bond ladder is the reinvestment risk of not knowing what interest rates will be in the future and then not knowing what kind of returns you'll get when you reinvest those bonds.
Professor, what about a combination? Because we all know that it's important to diversify your portfolio because it reduces risk and some things do better in certain market environments or economic environments. I think it's the same approach when it comes to investing. So I know you've done studies where you've done laddered bonds or bonds and stocks, and you've done studies with annuities and with stocks. In the different combinations that you have looked at, what have you found to be the most effective?
Well, really, the punchline of that is the way the math works out. You really don't need bond funds in retirement. It's basically, instead of thinking in terms of a stock and bond portfolio, it's a stock and income annuity portfolio. That the income annuity is really a type of bond fund. The insurance company is investing those assets in bonds, so it's getting the kind of returns you expect from a bond portfolio. But then it has this additional overlay of providing the income for precisely the amount of time that it's needed, which is how long that individual lives. And so it's a bond fund that's really matched to what the individual needs. And that allows it to be much more effective in retirement. And so you're getting that income not from the bonds, but from the income annuity, and then you're getting your upside growth potential from the stocks. So stocks plus income annuities is, I think, a great starting point to think about the retirement income problem.
So when you take a look at this, when I look at an income annuity, and you're right, they're not very popular with the financial world because they don't pay high commissions as the more complex products, but they provide what used to be provided decades ago, which were a defined benefit pension plan. You know, to me, I look as an immediate annuity as your own private pension plan.
Right. And that's exactly what it is. It is a pension. The fact that we have these two different words, there's not really a meaningful distinction between the word pension and annuity in the context of when both, although we have many other kinds of annuities now, but from the idea of providing an income for life, that's what a defined benefit pension did, and that's what an annuity does.
In today's environment, where we have a number of things going on, number one, some of the benefits of Social Security were reduced with the law that was passed last November. We've seen defined benefit pension plans go away. We've seen market returns be reduced, whether it's interest rates or the stock market. Wouldn't you recommend, if somebody is having difficulty, that they explore this option? Because to me, you know, it's either that or maybe it's you have to work longer or postpone retirement to a later age, or maybe you work part-time in retirement. But it seems like it's one tool that's available to individuals that they should explore, especially if they're looking for safety first and want that security, especially after going through two bear markets.
Right. It's an expensive time to retire in general. It's just because of this low interest rate world. And it's also a time when people are forced to take on more and more of the responsibility. With the traditional pension, it was the employer that was telling you the defined benefit. Your pension was going to be based on, well, they'll have a formula, like the number of years you worked and your ending salary, whatever the formula is. But it was then the firm, the employer, that was taking all the market risk to invest those assets. And now we're in this defined contribution world where the individuals are having to take on all that risk on their own and facing lower market returns. So that is a challenging time. It's really a time where people need to get some advice or assistance on how to really approach this and be able to put together a plan that can be expected to work.
Professor, if somebody was looking at an annuity as part of a, let's say, immediate annuity as part of their retirement solution, what things would you advise them to look for to make sure that it was the right type of annuity, it was a right fit for themselves? What would be the most important things? Let's say, for example, if you were retired and considering the same thing for yourself.
Well, you definitely want to look at the credit quality of the insurance company providing the annuity. You don't necessarily want to go with the firm that offers the highest payout rate. You really want to look at credit quality as well, and also look at each state will have a state guarantee association and what's the amount that can be covered by that. And then beyond that point, there are some different features to think about with the annuity. When do you want the income to start? Do you want right away, or do you want to lock in the premium now but have the income start a few years later, or 5 or 10 or even 20 years later is an option? Do you want to have a cost of living adjustment built into it, or do you just want the amount to stay fixed over time without any sort of upward adjustments? One of the risks of annuities is the idea of getting hit by the bus, that you sign the contract, pay the premium, leave the office, and get run over by a bus, and then your heirs are obviously in a bad situation. If that's a kind of risk that really worries you, there are provisions to either have a cash refund that if you die early, your heirs would be refunded any of your premium that had not been paid back as a payment, or to have at least a 10-year period certain where the income will continue for at least 10 years, no matter whether the person's still living or not. So there's those kinds of provisions. I think that's really the key provisions to think about in the world of the basic income annuity, a single premium immediate annuity or deferred income annuity, which are the cousins of the income annuity family.
As we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you publish a lot of articles when it comes to retirement income, being a specialist in this area. How could they find out more?
My personal website is retirementresearcher.com. It's all one word, just retirementresearcher.com.
Professor, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. You have yourself a great weekend and come back and talk to us again.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. Happy to be part of the show.
You know, coming out of this discussion you had with Wade Fowle, one of the things I just like whenever you're working on whatever the project has to be is lots of options, you know, options, options, options. And then you see how well you can put them together and make them work.
You know, you got to think outside the box today, because we're really living in a different environment. Gone are the days where we had a lot of security. And if there's one thing I hope you come out of this knowing is you do have options today, but those options are going to be much different. And secondly, the responsibility for your retirement is really shifting more to you, the retiree. Governments are doing it. We're seeing it with Social Security and Medicare. Companies have already done it with pension plans. And then also, we've seen the returns in the market. So you really need to do some planning here, folks, because, you know, the statistics are coming out. You see studies all the time. McKinsey just came out with a study this week saying that stock market returns based on what is going on in the economy, all the things that you're seeing, that stock market returns over the next decade are going to be 4%. Now, that's better than zero. But folks, the days of double digit returns each year, like a lot of these financial planning softwares use, where it's 10% return for the market, 6-7% in bonds. Heck, CalPERS is still using 8% assumptions, which are faulty. So the responsibility is basically shifting to you, the individual. But the important thing is, put together a plan. You have options. There's all kinds of alternatives that you have available to you. Well, that just about ends today's program. We went a little long, but I really wanted to get this in because we're seeing more and more cases, John, where individuals are just, they're almost starting to get to the panic point now because interest rates haven't gone up. Their cost of living has gone up. They're seeing benefits. I don't care if they're paying more for Medicare or Social Security increases aren't what they used to be. It's a different situation. So that's why we wanted to take that time today. Well, since we are out of time, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this week's Lifetime Income. Hope you enjoyed the program. We have a lot more programs coming up that I think you'll find of interest in the future. But in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you, and we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.